You're listening to SBS News.
There is a risk that there will be no Palestine left to recognise.
The situation is beyond catastrophic.
There's a good chance that there will be a meeting very soon.
Gerrymandering can be done, or drawing lines can be done, and there's nothing illegal about that.
Gloves are off, and I say bring it on.
Okay, we're back with another episode of World News Weekly. I'm Claudia Farhart in Bangkok. Our chief international correspondent, Ben Lewis, is with us in London today. Ben, seems like another week, another deadline from the White House.
Yeah, absolutely, Claudia. Last week it was tariffs. This week, Ukraine. Wonder what we'll get next week. It'll probably be 2 weeks, though. That's Donald Trump's favourite deadline. We're going to be chatting about both of those stories this week.
Plus, we've also got the war within Israel over the Prime Minister's new plans to conquer Gaza. And could the Lebanese government force Hezbollah to disarm?
And some interesting tactics along the border of North and South Korea. But first, Ukraine.
I don't call it a breakthrough. I mean, we've been working on this a long time. There are thousands of young people dying, mostly soldiers, but also, you know, missiles being hit into Kiev and other places. I'm here to get the thing over with. It would have never started if I were president, and we're here to get it stopped and get the death stopped.
U.S. President Donald Trump has said he plans to meet with Vladimir Putin as soon as next week, then hold a trilateral meeting with Volodymyr Zelensky as well. But he's still planning to move ahead with measures to hurt Russia's economy with sanctions and secondary tariffs, as President Putin will miss the Friday deadline Trump set for a ceasefire. All this comes after President Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, made a very brief trip to Moscow to speak directly with President Putin. Ben, what do you make of this plan for a meeting between the presidents? Do you think it's actually going to happen?
It's interesting as to if it will actually happen. So we heard Donald Trump say he only wants to meet with President Putin if the meeting is going to bring an end to the war. Now, it's a bit of a chicken and egg sort of situation, I mean, because the end of the war is not going to happen unless they meet. So it'll be interesting to see how that dynamic plays out. There's also just some pretty basic logistical factors involved here. Vladimir Putin is subject to an ICC arrest warrant. There are certain countries that he cannot go to. It would also have to be a country that Volodymyr Zelensky would be comfortable going to. So I suspect it would either be in Istanbul or in Riyadh. The question here really is, what does Vladimir Putin want? Does he want negotiations, direct talks with President Trump? Absolutely, yes. But does he really want to negotiate? Probably not. We've seen in the past Russia using delaying tactics again and again when Donald Trump has set a deadline. You get the sense that the same thing might be happening again here.
Yeah, and I guess the other question, one we've been asking over and over again, is does Putin actually want to end this war?
Yeah, only on his terms is the best way to put it. Now, the thoughts in Moscow are likely that these threats of sanctions and secondary tariffs on countries that buy Russian oil can probably be weathered for a reasonable period of time. And we know that Vladimir Putin really, at a very bare minimum, wants to take full control over four Ukrainian regions that Russia claims as its own. Now, one of the things we might hear the Kremlin suggest in the coming days is the idea of an aerial ceasefire, essentially saying no missiles, no drones, just ground fighting. That would work very well for Moscow. They could keep making slow progress in eastern Ukraine, and it would restrict Ukraine's ability to use drones to counter Russian advances. So it'll be interesting to see what proposals the Kremlin puts out over the coming week as it tries to set up this meeting.
Yeah, and Ben, we talk a lot about the US and Russia negotiating on this, but at the end of the day, it's Ukraine's future that's really at stake. What has the reaction to all of this been from Kyiv so far?
Yeah, really interesting reaction from Volodymyr Zelensky. So after this meeting with Witkoff and Vladimir Putin, Zelensky got on the phone to President Trump and European leaders. And after this, he did his little daily video on social media, and he said that it seems that Russia is now more inclined to agree to a ceasefire, that the pressure on them is working, but the main thing is that they do not deceive us or the United States in the details. Essentially, Ukraine likes the fact that Donald Trump is clearly frustrated with Vladimir Putin, is taking a tougher line, but at the same time, they're not sure that's going to last.
I think that the time has come for the Israelis to show their opposition in not unclear terms, which means to go to the streets.
That was former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert speaking there. And this week, some of Israel's most powerful figures in the former chiefs of the IDF, the Shin Bet and Mossad, as well as another former prime minister, have made a very public appeal to the prime minister to end the war in Gaza, saying it's now being driven by messianic and extremist goals rather than a realistic plan to free the hostages. With more talk around the world of recognizing Palestinian statehood, it certainly feels like we could be reaching a turning point here, but the Israeli Prime Minister appears to be turning in a very different direction.
Yes, as all that was happening, Benjamin Netanyahu was upping the stakes too. A senior Israeli official was quoted telling local journalists, "The die has been cast, we're going for the full conquest of the Gaza Strip." And the decision apparently has US backing, according to Israel's Channel 12.
So it feels like we're now coming to a point where we have to ask the question, who's more powerful, the far-right factions, elements holding Benjamin Netanyahu's coalition together or the military establishment within Israel? And can the military establishment actually refuse to carry out these plans if it's what the prime minister orders? We know that his far-right coalition partners want to go all in on this. These used to be ideas, the reoccupation of Gaza, that existed on the fringes of Israeli society. Those fringes now have very powerful representation within Benjamin Netanyahu's cabinet. But the current IDF chief, who Netanyahu appointed himself, is pushing back. He says this plan is only going to endanger the hostages and get the IDF stuck in another occupation. They only withdrew from Gaza a couple of decades ago. There is another school of thought on this, though, that this might be some sort of last-ditch effort to force Hamas into a hostage deal by raising the stakes, arguably higher than they've been raised ever before. But what do you make of it all, Ben?
Look, if this is a tactic to try and get Hamas back to the negotiating table, I'm not entirely sure it's going to work. They've been pretty sort of dismissive of these sorts of threats in the past. I heard something interesting said by Israeli opposition leader Yair Lapid during the week, and he said the idea of the conquest of Gaza is a very bad idea. He said you don't embark on such a move unless most of the nation is behind you. The people of Israel are not interested in this war. We will pay too high a price for it. And from my last trip to Israel about a month ago or so now, just speaking to people in the street, at restaurants, out on the road, people obviously want the hostages to come home, but there does not seem to be a groundswell of support for a broader full-scale occupation. You have to remember so many Israelis have been serving as reservists. It's been almost 2 years now that this has been going on. This does feel like it's almost entirely about domestic politics for Benjamin Netanyahu, the survival of his government. And really interestingly is the fact that Donald Trump has apparently told Netanyahu that the US is going to take a hands-off approach, do as you wish. Very different tone to what we've heard in the past, even when you think about Donald Trump talking about he's not liking the famine that he's seeing, he doesn't want to see starving children in Gaza. At the same time, he's basically giving the Israelis free rein.
Yeah, it's interesting because we saw some conflicting reports on that. We had the US Special Envoy, Steve Witkoff, meeting with some hostage families as well over the past week. And they say he told them, no, we have no plans to reoccupy Gaza. So it's hard to tell exactly what the US's position is on it. There's also a lot of questions coming out over how this is actually going to work practically if the Israeli cabinet does agree to go ahead with this plan. I mean, the IDF's already having massive manpower issues. Just a couple of weeks ago, it ordered a pretty substantial 30% reduction in its deployments. As you mentioned, a lot of people have been serving as reservists. I mean, some are on their seventh call-up in 22 months at this point. So there's huge fatigue in the army's ranks. And the military has also recently admitted a rise in suicides in its ranks too, including among soldiers who've been serving in Gaza. There's also this huge unresolved anger around the issue of yeshiva students, religious students, being given exemptions to serve, which is only adding more pressure to the people who keep getting called up and up over and over again, which was also a nod to those far-right elements of Netanyahu's coalition. The other thing is the IDF already controls 75% of the Strip, but within the military, there are serious questions being asked over their ability to actually take the rest of it. The army has said it would take them several years at this point to clear out the remainder of Hamas's infrastructure. So we heard about the former IDF chiefs, the former security chiefs speaking out. We also had an open letter from more than 600 former security officials to Donald Trump this week. They said everything that could be achieved by force has been achieved. So the consensus, I guess, from the military establishment is it's time to say enough is enough.
Yeah, and from some of those former military leaders as well, many have made the point that if the idea of this operation was to prevent Hamas from conducting another October 7 style operation, that has happened. They are not capable of conducting a similar operation in the future. What else is there left to achieve? One other thing about that region at the moment, I was speaking to, we heard from him earlier, former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert earlier, in the year, and he was saying, don't take your eyes off what's happening in the West Bank. That is a powder keg at the moment. We see repeatedly these situations with settlers intimidating and threatening Palestinians there. Keep an eye on what is going on there. That could be the next flashpoint.
Yeah, and on the West Bank, the US House Speaker Mike Johnson has also been saying this week he's now going to push for the US to stop referring to the territory as the West Bank and start using the biblical names Judea and Samaria. They're the names that Jewish settlers use to refer to the territory. So another sign, I think, that this Trump administration is really willing to go all in when it comes to supporting the settlements.
While we're talking about the Middle East, there was another big story we wanted to chat about out of Lebanon this week. The new cabinet has just asked the army to draw up plans to monopolise all weapons in the hands of the state by the end of the year, which is basically a long-winded way of saying figure out how to disarm Hezbollah. Lebanon's government has been facing huge pressure from the US on this one over the past couple of months, not just to get it done, but to get it done quickly. And now the cabinet has given the army until the end of this month to come up with a plan to make it happen. So what do you reckon, Claudia? Could we be looking at the end of Hezbollah as a militant group?
It's a tricky one for sure. On one hand, it kind of seems like the perfect timing to do this. Hezbollah was, until recently, the most heavily armed non-state actor in the world, far more powerful than the Lebanese army, in fact. But as we know, it was then decimated in its more than 1 year long war with Israel, both in terms of troop numbers, its leadership, but also its military arsenal, that formidable arsenal it had built up over decades since the Lebanese Civil War. On top of that, we now have this new government in Beirut, and they've made it clear they're not fans of the group at all. The new president, Joseph Aoun, in his very first speech back in January when he became president, spoke about disarmament from the get-go, unlike the former president, who actually counted Hezbollah as his closest allies, and without the group wouldn't have been able to hold on to power for so long. On the other hand, I think it's going to be a very hard sell to what is still a very significant supporter base in Lebanon, particularly in southern Lebanon. Yes, the group's down militarily, but they're not down politically. We know that from recent municipal elections that were happening in the south, where largely the group still held firm among its Shia supporter base. Yes, there is growing resentment towards the group, you know, in broader Lebanese society, but you could say that the resentment towards Israel right now is greater. Israel is still occupying five key areas in southern Lebanon, areas on hills, strategic sites that they say they maintain for surveillance. They're still keeping up attacks in the south of Lebanon as well. They say they're attacking Hezbollah sites, targeting Hezbollah's attempts to rebuild its arsenal and rebuild its troop force as well, despite the ceasefire. So the Lebanese mindset on this, though, is that without Israel and without the threat from Israel, there'd be no Hezbollah. The group was formed during Israel's first invasion of Lebanon back in the 80s, and it was Hezbollah that really ended what turned into an 18-year Israeli occupation by forcing them to withdraw. So they have this image as the defender of the borders in Lebanon. They've done that, they say, when the state couldn't. And many still feel that way, even outside their Shia base. But I think, Ben, if the government can pull this off, if they can actually get Hezbollah to disarm and only exist in a political arena in the future, it's going to be the single most powerful thing they can do to really restore international trust in Beirut after years of economic and political crisis, and potentially restore international funding for this government as well as it tries to rebuild the country.
Yeah, absolutely. International investment is critical for Lebanon at the moment. There might still be a few shaky weeks ahead as Beirut tries to get this plan together. Now, Hezbollah has already come out and said they're not going to disarm under Israeli military pressure or even take part in talks on this until Israel stops its strikes. And the group's new leader has also threatened to resume firing into Israel if those IDF strikes don't stop. And you might think that that fighting between Hezbollah and Israel has stopped. I mean, this was all wrapped up months ago. But if you pay close attention, you'll see the IDF is still conducting airstrikes in southern Lebanon on an almost daily basis. Mm. The war is quieter than it was, but it is still going in a way.
It's well past time that President Trump was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize.
I deserve it, but they will never give it to me.
Well, any progress getting Hezbollah to disarm might once have been something for the US president to celebrate, but Donald Trump is still fighting more fires at home. The US monthly job figures, the latest thing to cause his ire. So much so, he promptly fired the head of the US Bureau of Labor Statistics, or BLS, accusing them of rigging the numbers to make his administration look bad.
Yeah, not quite sure what this is going to achieve, because the BLS head plays no role in collecting the data or putting the numbers together. They're highly scrutinised practices. Outrage and criticism was swift, evidenced by a slew of Trump's people taking to the US Sunday shows to defend the move. The issue, of course, is one of trust. If the data can no longer be trusted, then it has a big effect on lending and policymaking. The markets, though, have been more concerned by Trump forging ahead with tariffs. As his latest deadline approached, he published a list of countries and the specific tariffs he would apply to them. Australia got off relatively lightly, by the way, with just 10%, although some key industries like pharmaceuticals are still waiting with bated breath to see how they are going to be dealt with. And if that wasn't enough to keep Trump busy, he has openly called for congressional boundaries in Texas to be redrawn to give him more seats in the midterm elections. Gerrymandering is not only a wonderful word, it is also a long-held tradition, of course, but it is usually done every 10 years after the census, and it's a hotly contested practice. With the next census another 5 years away, the Republican-controlled Texas state legislature is trying to ram this through, but has hit a bit of a Democratic roadblock. Namely, a slew of them got up and left the state so there wouldn't be a quorum for the vote. Now, the spat is bringing in other Democrat-controlled states like California, whose governor, Gavin Newsom, is happy to take on the fight, although possibly not entirely for altruistic purposes, as he is seen as a potential presidential candidate, and a showdown with Republicans could help his cause.
Yeah, this appears to be the moment both parties are really putting on the gloves ahead of the midterm elections. So I think we can expect to see more partisan punch-ups and rampant rhetoric as the battle lines are drawn, Ben. All right, time for a look at some of the other big stories around this week. Myanmar's military junta has just ended its 4-year state of emergency ahead of planned elections for later this year. The junta is saying the vote will end the conflict and secure democracy, but opposition groups and international monitors are calling it out as a fraud designed to legitimise their military rule.
The fighting could escalate ahead of the poll, with analysts expecting rebel groups to launch new offensives as a sign of their opposition. The junta is already moving to crack down on dissent, though, putting into place new laws that make undermining the electoral process punishable by 10 years jail.
Armed bandits have kidnapped more than 50 people in northwestern Nigeria in a mass abduction. There were similar incidents last month, with the bandits killing at least 35 people after their ransoms were paid.
Nigeria's long been dealing with a banditry crisis, but monitoring groups say they're now moving from land conflict into organised crime. And they're now largely preying on these rural villages that have little or no government presence.
And Pakistan has arrested more than 200 protesters rallying to mark the second anniversary of Imran Khan's arrest. The former Prime Minister was charged with dozens of offences ranging from leaking state secrets to selling state gifts, all of which his supporters say were politically motivated.
Yeah, the government put a ban on gatherings in the capital ahead of the demonstrations after Khan sent a message to his supporters asking them to come out and hold peaceful protests until a true democracy is restored.
Okay, Ben, if you're wondering what that was, it was the sound of some of South Korea's finest sledging, courtesy of the loudspeakers they had set up along the border to blare propaganda into North Korea. Some of what they were saying just there, while Kim Jong-un drinks expensive wine, you are forced to scavenge for food. Ouch. And it must be difficult doing all that unappreciated work on a minefield.
It's a fair point. If you're going to work on a minefield, you want to be appreciated. However, the border is going to be a little quieter now. South Korea has started dismantling the speakers this week in an effort to ease tensions with their northern neighbours. Pyongyang had asked for them to be taken down, saying the messages were psychologically detrimental to its people.
As sick burns usually are. The speakers have been there since the 60s and have blasted everything from K-pop to news reports across the border in that time. They had stopped until last year, but then North Korea sent hundreds of trash balloons across the border and the South decided to resume programming. The North Koreans had also set up speakers, which just play scary sounds into South Korea. I had a listen to some of them this morning and I got to admit, Ben, they are kind of terrifying.
Yeah, quite spooky. I'm going to get those South Korean speakers, set them up in my backyard here in London and just pump out World News Weekly once a week to inform my neighbours.
I think it's a good strategy, Ben. It's a good strategy. And on that note, we should probably leave it there. But that is The World This Week. Ben, thanks very much for joining us.
Catch you next time.